Every location has its own resilient story. It has its own 44 value story.
This morning, I get the chance to talk with Adam again. The first time we went through his life, this time we're going to go through what he's doing as his profession. Adam, thank you for coming again.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Really? I mean, when you called me and said, Lance, you remember you said you invited me back? And I said, yes, I did. You said, well, I'm ready. I said, well, let's do it.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's a very prompt response. Yeah, and I'm very happy to be here because last time it was, for me, a very enjoyable experience to be able to spend that time speaking with you.
That was really nice.
So, yeah. And before I answer any questions, I'll answer your questions right after this message.
All right.
So if you're looking for some new information in your life that you haven't had yet, if you want some new insights, if you want some insights into living in Japan, this, the Lance E. Lee podcast, that's where you want to come. The content is constantly being updated. It's constantly interesting. A whole range of interesting characters, fascinating backgrounds. Come along to the Lance E. Lee podcast and you will not be disappointed. And I'd just like to say after that a few words about Lance E. Lee's professionalism. This guy is churning out these podcasts day after day. It's an incredibly difficult thing to do. You should see the setup in this room. And he sets it up every morning, early in the morning. A new guest comes in, he sets it all up, he takes it all down afterwards. It's an incredible endeavor, and he's been doing it already for more than 300 episodes. It's a really, really impressive achievement. And what I would also like to say in closing is that when he gets off camera, on camera, he seems like a very serious, intense interviewer, and he is. But you get him off camera, this guy is one of the most entertaining guys on the planet. I have to tell you that. If you get him on a day when he's sparkling, he is a wellspring of wit, of incredible insights, of fascinating anecdotes. So if you ever have a chance to be a guest on the Lance E. Lee podcast, you will not regret it.
And you would think I paid him to do that, right? Let me say this. He left out one thing.
Yeah.
If you come to the podcast, you get breakfast.
Oh, that's a very important point. Yeah, I was just telling Lance that's the main reason I came back this time, actually. The breakfast is really good.
Oh, now back to you, Adam. That was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Well, you deserve it.
Oh, that is beautiful. My goodness. And you see, you do work with NHK, right? You used to work with NHK. You mentioned that before.
Yep. I still work with NHK. We do a lot of work with NHK at my company. My company is called Fulford Enterprises. And we set it up in 1985. It's been going for, what, nearly 40 years. And most of that time has been very much focused on NHK.
How many people do you have working with you?
I'm saying in the office as if it, you know, the coronavirus thing never happened. I mean, a lot of people now work from home. So it varies a little bit from year to year, but essentially working closely with me, a team of about five people, project managers mainly, but that's people good. Who can also translate, people who can also support the other thing that I hope we'll be talking about today, which is regional engagement.
Okay.
But for NHK, we translate the scripts for TV programs that are shown on, for example, NHK World, which is shown around the planet, is visible to people with a computer anywhere in the world. And through that, over the years, and through programs that I've supported that are shown domestically in Japan, I've had a chance to experience many, many different facets of Japanese culture. It was an incredible education for which essentially I was being paid. Right now, NHK World, you've got an hour of programming, 30 minutes is hard news, then the other 30 minutes is cultural, is presenting aspects of Japan that people might not know about and so on. And so every single week, I'm learning something new about Japan.
Because NHK is the national television station, they don't allow you to promote anything there, right?
Actually, that's true.
They have a rule about that. You can't show your brand, you can't talk about your company. But they'll let you do it. There's other ways to get around that.
Well, interestingly enough, the channel that we work for, which is NHK World Japan, they have a slot that a sponsor can buy every week. So if there was a sponsor that was interested in presenting something about Japan with commercials, there is a slot, a 28-minute slot every week for that purpose. So it can be done. But that's because it's being shown outside Japan. So it's not subject to the normal restrictions. If anybody is interested in
but that. But it has to be about Japan.
It's about Japan, yeah, because it's NHK World Japan.
Of course.
But it might be, for example, about what a company is doing, for example, in regional Japan, or what the government is doing in regional Japan. There are various, there are government sponsors, there are private sponsors. So there is a big opportunity there, and it's actually, I think, pretty cost effective to deliver a message to the world and engage with the international community in a new way. So for example, regional companies, there are many successful regional companies that are largely unknown outside the region, but they make great products, they provide great services, and through that kind of window to the world, they can become known to, for example, travelers coming into Japan, tourists who might then visit that region and think, oh, that's the product that I saw on that program, I'm gonna buy that. So, or perhaps they'll reach out and say, I would really love to work with your company, because for many of these regional companies, that's a huge challenge these days, is getting enough labor to move forward.
That brings us into the point that you were talking about. You said everyone's talking about the digital society now.
Yeah.
How do you term that?
Well, DX is being used a lot in Japan these days, along with other various kinds of X, and the X is always transformation. So it's the green transformation or whatever it is, GX and that kind of thing. DX is used by a lot of Japanese companies particularly to talk about how they are essentially getting with the program in the 21st century. They're embracing digital technology. But what I started to feel and feel now very strongly is that what's getting left behind is the actual real human being. So digital transformation, obviously that makes our lives easier. It makes it easier for us to get things done efficiently and effectively. But at the end of the day, we are all members of many different communities. And if we do not have a fully resourceful personality, those communities are going to suffer, is the way that I think about it. At the end of the day, in the old days, everybody was resourceful because they had to be. If they weren't resourceful, the community to which they belonged would start to weaken and collapse. But if you had mechanisms in the community for bringing out the resourcefulness of each individual, there's a better chance that community is going to survive. You've done an incredible job of bringing out the resourcefulness of your members at the Tokyo American Club. And that's why the Tokyo American Club is now a very vibrant, successful community. That's the second plug today.
Right. Thank you.
You know, village in the countryside where they had a lot of snow in the winter. How are we going to get through to spring? So you had to be able to draw out the full potential of everybody in the community just to survive. It wasn't about, you know, how are we going to live a peaceful, abundant, happy life. You know, that was just not a conceivable target. It was just, how are we going to get through to spring? And that required bringing out the skills that were available in the community. You can't waste time in that context. It's life or death. And so through that kind of activity in the Japanese countryside in many, many different places, they started coming up with a set of values, a set of ways of thinking and being and doing that enabled the community to keep going. And of course, some of them did fail. But you end up with a kind of a Darwinian set of survival values. And a Japanese professor that I know called Furukawa Ryuzo, he interviewed something like 600 people aged 90 and over, Japanese people mainly, about what life was like before convenience.
How long ago was this?
He started about 15 years ago. So when they were 90 years old 15 years ago, they were already a pretty good, you know, they were adults basically before the Second World War. And before the Second World War around regional Japan, there was no expectation of convenience. And then of course in the war years, it got even worse. So he was saying, you know, actually, what did you do in everyday life? You know, tell me about your everyday life in those days. How did you get through? You know, what kind of things were important for you? And he'd just listen for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And then his students would transcribe the tapes. And from that, he was able to essentially distill what he calls the 44 disappearing lifestyle values. And that list is available on the internet. Yes. There's a provisional English translation as well. And what I do now is I use that in regional Japan, where I've been active now for about the last 10 years, in bringing out the story of each location. Because every location has its own resilient story. It has its own 44 value story. So in some locations, they'll have a certain way of collaborating. In another location, it's a slightly different way of collaborating. You will clearly see the local resources, the natural resources that are available in each community that they brought to the table in order to survive.
Tell me this, how do they get together? How do they organize? They decide to have a community group?
Oh, for the 600?
For each area, each area.
He just went around all over Japan and interviewed people.
Okay.
So he was.
Now, how did the groups in those areas get together?
Well, that would have been like, for example, you would be thinking the original kind of smallest unit of community in a Japanese village. One typical example was what they call goningumi. So that's five people group. And this is something that became more formal, I think, in the Edo period. But the idea is that you've got your home, you've got the home on either side of you, and you've got the two homes across the road. And that essentially becomes your community, your base community. Of course, there's a family inside the home, which is very, very important. But each of these homes in the old days would have had maybe 8-10 people. So you're talking about five. Oh, sorry, actually, it's the two on either side of you and the three across the road. I think that's what it was. So you've got a group of maybe 60 people, and that's already a sizable community in which various people will be able to display what they can bring to the table. And so when you need new straw shoes, we'll ask that person because they're the person who's great at doing them. If you need somebody to preserve vegetables, we'll ask that person because they're great at preserving the vegetables. If you need somebody to build a new home, oh, well, those two, they're great at doing that kind of stuff. So you already in that community are working out how to make the best possible use of the human resources available to you. And those communities would have been part of a larger community. In the Edo period, there would also have been a certain sense of perhaps reporting on what was going on because the central authorities wanted to have a careful understanding of what was going on at the local level. But that remains to a certain extent in remote regions. There are still places that claim to have goningumi. So a place that I work with in northeast Japan, a guy moved in there 30, 40 years ago. So this is 1980 maybe, when I first came to Japan. And one of the first things he had to do was bury a 95-year-old man who just died, a member of that community, and hold the funeral. By coming into the community, he had to demonstrate that he was a member of the community. And the first big task he had was to run a funeral for the community. Because many people in the community were in mourning, and it was kind of like, this is not the time that we want to be busy, you're a newcomer, you do it, whatever the reasoning was. But through that, he became a member of the community. He demonstrated that he could do what they regarded as valuable. And so that contribution to the community has become a huge theme for me as well. If you go into the community and you take photographs, you buy a souvenir, and you go home, well, you've left some money in the community. I mean, that is a form of contribution. And so travel, tourism, it's a huge industry for Japan. It's a very, very important industry. But why not do something extra that the community is actually grateful for? And that's what I keep aiming for in regional Japan, is how can we set up little activities where people coming into the community think, oh, I'm glad I did that.
Give me an example of some of these activities.
Well, for example, I've been working a lot with Vietnamese recently in northeast Japan. The number of Vietnamese is rapidly increasing in Japan. There are now something like 400,000 Vietnamese. In Japan, 10 years ago, almost none. So the particular city I'm working with, Koryama, there were maybe 8 or 9 Vietnamese 10 years ago. Now there are 700 or 800, many of them working in local factories, doing the kind of work that Japanese people would have been doing 10 years before that. But gradually, as the Japanese population shrinks, as that kind of work becomes less and less attractive to Japanese, they have to find somebody else who can do it. And right now, digital transformation won't do the job. These are jobs that really are quite tedious in many cases, like checking something for tiny flaws every single day. And they found that it was possible to recruit people as trainees from Southeast Asia, and Vietnam has been a particularly good example of that. And so these trainees would come to Japan, and in effect, they would be supporting the company's business and productivity. And then after 3, 4, 5 years, they'd go home. And when they went home, what would they say? They would say, I've just spent 4 years doing a very, very boring job in Japan, but I made some money, and now I'm thinking more brightly about my future in Japan. But in some bad cases, they're going home and saying, I got treated really badly in Japan. If you're thinking of going there, I'd think twice. So some of them will definitely be saying that. What happens then is that the regional companies find it more and more difficult to recruit the people they need for their future. And so why am I focusing on Vietnamese? It's to give them a sense that we are grateful for what they're doing. I want to give them a sense that it's actually fun to be in Japan. I've done something in Japan that I couldn't have done in Vietnam. I've got a nice story to tell my friends, my family. I'm going to put it on social media. And people will think, oh, well, if I go to Koriyama, if I go to Fukushima, then maybe it's actually going to be a really interesting experience and not just the job that I have to essentially tolerate. So a specific example, just last year, we got a group of Vietnamese together to go to a local temple where every year at this time of year, this is November, the leaves fall. And somebody has to brush up the leaves. And again, because in the local community there are fewer and fewer hands to go around, it turned out that the local temple priest was quite grateful for the idea that we could have a day where we're essentially picking up the leaves. And so a group of Vietnamese come to the temple, we sweep up the leaves, put it in bags, that spent about 2 hours doing that. Local people come in and think, oh, what are you doing? You know, and so we can explain. And they think, oh, the Vietnamese are actually making a contribution to our community. Isn't that nice? That changes perception slightly, because until then, maybe they've heard that there are Vietnamese around, but they don't actually see them, and they don't see them engaging in positive ways with the community. So they pick up the leaves. What happens next? Well, we have to have lunch. So we get together with some of the people, for example, who run local farmhouse bed and breakfasts. They're always amazing cooks. So they start cooking something up while we're picking up the leaves. The Vietnamese come along and we start eating, and the Vietnamese also bring along their own things that they want to eat. And so the local people from the farmhouse B&B say, oh, how do you use that? I've never eaten that before. And the Vietnamese are saying, so what's different about this? Why is this particular kind of soup unique to this area? They start having little conversations. And as a result of that, one of the Vietnamese struck up a friendship with one of the people from a local farmhouse B&B. And that person makes dried, now I'm going to say it the British way, persimmons.
Persimmons, right.
She just makes them every year as part of her everyday activity. But that young Vietnamese woman loved dried persimmons. Mm, right. And so she said, can you show me how to make them? And so this person, Nakamura-san, showed her how to make them. She took a whole bunch to where the Vietnamese was working in a local hotel. She turned up at reception with a whole bag of persimmons last year. And the Vietnamese woman took it home, started making it herself. They were sending photographs and so on to check everything was going okay. And then when she'd made them, she sold them. So we had a little Christmas market last year in the community, and she had her own stall selling her dried persimmons. And of course, Nakamura-san comes along with some, you know, here's some lunch. You can't just be standing out here in the cold all day long. Here's some lunch for you. And so through these connections, very, very micro connections, you start to get a sense of storytelling. Oh, I met that nice young Vietnamese woman at the Christmas market that she was selling dried persimmons. No, was she? How did she do that? Why is she doing that? And the stories start to come out, and people start thinking, oh, well, it's very natural for people from these other countries to be standing alongside us at these local events and contributing to the community.
How does your company get involved and what does your company do that helps to facilitate this?
So essentially, I go along there and I think things up. My role is to think things up.
That would help them to work together.
Yeah.
And that's for all the communities you go to?
Yes, essentially I come up with ideas.
Okay.
As a very rough estimate, nine out of 10 ideas are terrible, and then something sticks.
Right.
But gradually the percentage is going up. The more experience I get, the more I understand what can and cannot be done, the more I understand what the local barriers might be to moving things forward. But it started about 10 years ago with a tiny community in the mountains of Yamagata. And that is very much where my heart remains. It's a community that was 300 people back then. It's now down to 200. And it has a very, very rich local culture that deserves to be noticed by people all over the world. But the strength of the community is very, very difficult to maintain when the numbers are going down. And it's also very, very difficult to think about conventional tourism because the hospitality infrastructure is also growing much weaker. So when I first went there, there were 7 or 8 farmhouse B&Bs in a community of 300 people, which is impressive. But now, how many of them are functioning? Well, a lot of them will still say that they're actually functioning as before, but it's getting more and more difficult. A lot of the people who are central to that activity are in their 70s, their 80s. And so we really need to find a revolutionary new way of engaging with the community. And I think that contribution is going to play a key role in that.
Immigration has to be changed too in Japan, because they have very stringent immigration laws.
Yeah.
So when the people come, sometimes they want to stay and they find it almost impossible to be able to do so.
Yes.
After they've worked here. And that also doesn't play fair for, that doesn't help Japan in any way.
No.
So they're going to have to overcome that. That's going to be another hurdle that's going to be very challenging.
Yes.
To say the least.
It's going to be very challenging, but the government already recognizes that the systems they have in place right now do need to be changed. Mm-hmm. We don't know yet exactly how they will be changed, but it's clear that it's going to become easier not only for example, Vietnamese to come to Japan and actually work, not just being trainees, but actually to work. And also, it's already easier than it was before for some of those Vietnamese to move on to another company. So before they were kind of locked in, but now they can switch companies in some cases. That's a big step forward. But obviously, it's not only the visa status, it's also how do we integrate with the local community so that everything goes smoothly from a social point of view as well. Because people in rural Japan are not accustomed to having people from other countries living next door to them or whatever it is. There are various hurdles that need to be overcome, but it seems to me that this contribution is one of the quickest ways of breaking through those barriers.
Now, when you say contribution, you mean the people that are coming in, how they contribute to the area they're in.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I was going to say.
No, but so for example, when I was starting my engagement with this little village in Yamagata in northeast Japan, they have a lot of snow in the winter. And so one of the things that we did, I went along with friends of mine from the international community, really people from as many different realms of experience and expertise as I could find. And you'll know some of them, actually. We should talk about that later. But we'd go out there, they'd be from children up to people my age, people running companies, people who are teaching, people who are business consultants, people who are already working in regional Japan. And the reason I went out there in the first place with people like that was I needed to outsource my brain. Because if I was going out there and looking at things, obviously all I can do is filter it through my own experience and expertise. And I didn't really know what to do. So I thought, well, maybe if I bring along some friends who can see things from different angles, we'll come to a conclusion that's actually positive for everybody. And that actually started to happen. One example of that, I won't go into the detail of what it was, but there's a very well-known, let's call him a government consultant, who came up with an idea at a workshop that we did on the third day of our engagement that was then repeated by an 11-year-old a few months later. And that really, it made it very clear to me that it doesn't matter. If you expose people to interesting forms of stimulus, then interesting ideas will start to bubble up. But what was the stimulus initially? Well, for example, we would clear snow from around an elderly person's house. Spend about 2 hours doing that, and the person would obviously, well, not obviously perhaps, but they would feel very grateful. They would bring us apples and so on. You've got to have some of my apples and all of this. And we would have a group photograph and it would end in a very happy way. We would do various other experiences in the community, but that would be a very simple form of contribution. And then I'd have a very simple survey at the end of it. What was the thing that you most enjoyed over the last 3 days? Clearing snow. And I'd report that back to the village and they'd just laugh. Because clearing snow is the bane of their life.
Of course.
Up at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning to get snow away from the car so they can drive to work. So that kind of experience, it just opens eyes in new ways. And people can start thinking in ways that they didn't think before about various possibilities. And then I started repeating that with students, university students, and they started going out there on their own. And then everything was derailed by the coronavirus. And I'm now, actually, just to let you know, at the very end, what I was moving towards at that stage was something, you know about JICA?
JICA, yes.
The Japan International Cooperation Agency, which does great work all over the world. And I think a lot of people around the world are very grateful for what JICA does. But I started thinking, why doesn't it go in the other way? Why aren't there international organizations that are actually contributing, for example, to regional Japan? Why don't we have an African International Cooperation Agency. What could an African International Cooperation Agency do? ICA. And I was just at that time actually speaking with somebody from Rwanda who was operating a fashion week in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. And I said to him, hey, what about doing a fashion week or a fashion day or a fashion evening in regional Japan? And we started building on that idea, in fact. And what would have happened if we'd actually managed to realize it would have been maybe in a local gym. There are loads of empty spaces in regional Japan that you can use. We would set it up like the Paris collection, you know, with the full production values. But the models would be local grandmothers, and they'd be wearing Rwandan fashions. And I really, really wanted to see that. But then, essentially, you know, coronavirus derailed all of those plans.
Adam, on that note, if people wanted to get in contact with you, because I'm sure that you're looking for as many people as possible to help you do what you're doing in Japan, how would they do so?
Well, I think the simplest is, maybe you can put it on the screen as I say this, contact me at contact, C-O-N-T-A-C-T, at Fulfordent, F-U-L-F-O-R-D-E-N-T.com. So that's contact at Fulfordent.com. And you heard it first here on the Lance Ely podcast.
Adam, with that, look, we're going to have to do this again.
Please.
Go on.
Yeah.
This again and see what kind of results you're getting, because I'm sure you will.
Well, I'd love you to come out as well.
I will. I would like to do that sometime.
Please do.
I really would.
Yeah.
No joke. I mean, I'd really like to do that because I love going around Japan. I usually do it by motorcycle.
Oh, really?
So if you're going to go someplace and you tell me where you're going to be, I would love to come out there, park my bike, which is a conversation piece in its own.
Oh, right.
And then, you know, help you with whatever you're doing. I would enjoy that.
November the 12th.
November the 12th.
It's a Sunday.
Sunday I have a class in the morning. But we may not be, we'll find a date.
Okay.
That's going to work.
Just throwing that one out there. It happens to be a day when there are going to be a lot of Vietnamese in the on a tour that I'm running that
day. That's interesting. That's good. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank all of you for watching and listening to the podcast. Remember, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.